Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Well, folks, in today's second hour, I have a new guest for Truth News Radio and a very, very important topic. We are going to be talking about nuclear power. We're going to be getting into questions about the Fukushima disaster. But I have a lot more issues and questions around the whole topic of nuclear power that I'm going to be raising with our guest, Paul Gunter, from the group BeyondNuclear.org. Paul Gunter is the director of the Reactor Oversight Project, and he has a lot of experience in nuclear reactors and their risks. And he has been involved as an activist in anti-nuclear movements for very many years. So a warm welcome now to Paul Gunter. Welcome to Truth News Radio Australia.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Absolutely. Paul, I'd like to cover a few different main areas during our interview. I want to talk about nuclear power generally, the state of the technology, the various risks, and the main thrust of your focus of your organization. I want to talk about Fukushima in detail, and I really feel that we have been starved of information about Fukushima, and it's really frustrating because it is such a significant catastrophe that occurred there, and yet we did get a trickle of information from the mainstream news about it. So I want to get as much as you can tell us about what's actually really happening there and what the latest developments are. And then I kind of want to get into the question of the debate over nuclear power, because this is one that, again, we get a trickle of information about it. We get a lot of pro-nuclear people coming forwards. We have people like yourself who are against nuclear energy more or less across the board. And I want to resolve what are the key, you know, debate points and what is your take on them. But look, let's just begin, if we can, with your overview of nuclear power in the world today, where it's headed, and what do you think needs to be done?
Well, thank you again for having us on. You know, our main concern right now is that this is essentially a 70-year-old technology.
Yeah.
That was originally developed as a production industry for nuclear weapons material. The first nuclear reaction here in the United States was at Chicago, University of Chicago, for the production of plutonium for one of the bombs that was dropped on Japan during World War II. And the development of commercial nuclear power essentially, as documents that we have, beginning with in 1952, yeah, from the Atomic Energy Commission, establish that the initial contract between U.S. industry and the U.S. government for commercial nuclear power was to use the byproduct heat associated with the development of plutonium and nuclear weapons material, to use that heat to generate steam for the purpose of spinning a turbine and generating electricity. So there's a complete white paper out that shows that the initial development here in the United States was, the thrust of it was, where plutonium weapons grade nuclear materials was a byproduct, the electricity was a byproduct of the development of plutonium. And you know, that sort of is true all across the board. Yeah. With the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, France, England, you know, and these are the agenda was for the development of nuclear materials and to use that excess heat for electricity. And that's essentially where, you know, you get this notion that nuclear power would be too cheap to meter because it was a government project. And essentially, that is the situation all around the world right now. Governments are generally behind the development of nuclear power, not the market. So there is this inextricable link between nuclear power and nuclear weapons, and that is a great concern for not only planetary survival but peace in general. Given that this industry now is so old, many of the, particularly here in the United States, most of the nuclear power plants are approaching now 40 years old, and there is reactor relicensing going on, where reactors are getting 20-year extensions, but essentially this is an aging industry. Here in the United States, clearly nuclear power is in decline.
Yeah.
We had 4 reactor closures last year, and more anticipated this year. The status of nuclear power here in the United States is that the industry is in decline. It's no longer able to compete, particularly with natural gas, but renewable energy, particularly wind power in our Midwest, is driving nuclear power out of competition. And as the profit motive is lost on this very inherently dangerous industry, less money is going into maintenance, surveillance, retrofits. It's the industry is degrading. There is some development going on around the world. There are about 65 units under construction around the world of the 440 that are operating right now. There are an additional 65, but generally speaking, the thrust of that development is in countries like China. We recently saw news that the French government, which is one of the primary contractors with China, is very concerned about the lack of quality control, quality assurance, going into the construction of the Chinese reactors, which are the Chinese government, again, is trying to build this industry up very quickly and taking shortcuts in the process. And this is not an industry that you take shortcuts with without increased risk. And so that is, there's generally a decline over the past several years in nuclear power worldwide, even with this new construction going forward. And overall, the situation is, looking at the entire uranium fuel cycle, that it is still, for this technology, an open-ended technology dumping nuclear waste into the environment, essentially without a long-term management plan. No country operating nuclear power in the world today has a scientifically accepted, demonstrated long-term management plan for nuclear waste, which will, I think it's easy to understand that nuclear waste is the legacy of nuclear power. Electricity is but a fleeting byproduct. The real legacy of nuclear power right now is about 250,000 metric tons of high-level nuclear waste, principally irradiated fuel, sitting largely on site at all these various reactors, submerged in underwater, which is not a long-term strategy. It's very vulnerable to severe climate issues. It's certainly a security issue if any of that water is lost, or the power for cooling this extremely hot radioactive waste. presents a trajectory towards more catastrophes like we've seen at Fukushima.
Absolutely. And I think you've highlighted there that the concept of risk in nuclear energy is, in some ways, it's unique compared to any other form of energy generation. And the risks are so huge that even when proponents of nuclear energy can say, well, it's actually very safe, and they can say, well, there's only, you know, there's hardly been any accidents, it's a very safe industry, the risks are so big that if we have one accident, it kind of throws everything out of the water, because the consequences of one accident, for example Fukushima or Chernobyl, are so huge. But then the consequences of the potential for what might happen to that waste product going on into the future, for what sort of, what are we talking, thousands of years? I mean, this material is going to remain dangerous for thousands of years. Is that correct?
Well, actually, for millennia. I mean, we're talking tens of thousands of years and beyond. Here in the United States, just this past year, we have had a nuclear waste accident. The Waste Isolation Pilot Project in Carlsbad Cavern, New Mexico. This is a government nuclear waste geological repository in a salt body in New Mexico that was licensed to operate for 10,000 years. And that was its environmental review. And after 15 years of operation, we now have plutonium escaping from 2,000 feet below and has contaminated about 36 workers right now that were on the surface in the open atmosphere. We have releases of plutonium. So the concern is that, you know, even these projected long-term repositories are vulnerable to failure on very short notice. So the geological repository concept has proven to be very, very sketchy, if not a failure. The Waste Isolation Pilot Project, or WIP as it's referred to, is now closed. And this is principally where the U.S. nuclear waste from its weapons production program, primarily plutonium and americium, was being taken for deep geological burial. That concept has now failed. The principal amount of nuclear waste generated here in the United States, though, we have about 67,000 metric tons of high-level radioactive waste sitting at our the 135 reactors that we have. Only 100 of them are now operational.
We're just going to break. Sorry to interrupt. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We are going to break. We'll be right back. I'm talking to Paul Gunter about nuclear power. Very great interview. Stay with us. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. Going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. My guest today is Paul Gunter from beyondnuclear.org, and we are talking about nuclear power, and we've been sort of going through an overview of the whole industry, the history, and all the various problems associated with it. Tremendous level of risk associated with this industry, And I want to just highlight again, one of the key risks, of course, which you highlighted at the beginning, Paul, was that in every country where nuclear power is adopted, it tends to be associated with a nuclear weapons industry. But we do get exceptions. I mean, we have Iran, for example, saying they only want to develop peaceful nuclear energy. But it sounds like from what you are saying, it's almost too tempting for any government to have a nuclear program without developing nuclear weapons, because they kind of go together, and the nuclear power industry tends to be a spin-off from the development of the weapons. I mean, how viable is it for a country just to say, well, we're just going to develop nuclear energy and we're not going to develop weapons? Is it even economically viable to do that?
Well, it's basically a handshake deal,
yeah,
if you will. The clear example is North Korea.
Yeah.
North Korea was a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty to gain access to the infrastructure for the development of nuclear materials for supposed peaceful purposes. As soon as they generated the nuclear materials, they broke off from the NPT, and they are now a nuclear weapons possessor.
Yeah.
This is going to be the story. Once the nuclear materials are in the possession of the government agenda, it's simply a question then of do you dare to walk away from the deal? This is a big concern. For example, Japan right now is a signatory to the NPT, but there is a general agreement that Japan could easily develop nuclear weapons from its stockpile, a huge stockpile, yeah, of plutonium, within a matter of months. They,
wow,
could have enough nuclear weapons to be a significant threat. And then it's just really a question of, you know, do you consider them on your side or an adversary?
Yeah.
But the simple possession of weapons that ultimately mean global destruction is nuclear weapon technology represents a threat to all life on the planet.
Absolutely. And do you have any views on Iran? Do you have any insights as to what's actually going on there?
I think that generally speaking, the concern is that Iran is looking to develop nuclear weapons. They are a signatory to the NPT.
Yeah.
They under the NPT, Article 6 provides that you have an inherent right to develop nuclear materials for peaceful purposes. Iran is pursuing that. But the general structure of the Non-Proliferation Treaty provides for nothing more than a handshake deal for the development of nuclear power for peaceful purposes. But always in the background is the capability to walk away from the deal. And then you enter into essential conflict that develops, as we're seeing right now with all the saber rattling, particularly between Israel and Iran,
yeah,
where countries then with significant concerns, security concerns, begin to consider preemptive strikes, as we have seen with where Israel attacked Syria, because they feared that Syria's development of nuclear technology represented a clear and present danger to Israel, and so they sent the Israeli Air Force in there and bombed the Osirak nuclear facility. So even the development of nuclear power for peaceful purposes can set up what we've already seen demonstrated as preemptive strikes that are potentially trigger points for war, in particularly in the Middle East right now, where we have about 13 countries looking to develop nuclear technology.
It's like a trigger for militarism. It's a trigger for war simply because of what it signifies, and it can be manipulated, but for geopolitical reasons, I can see it's a whole other angle on this, which people don't often consider when we talk about the risk and benefit of nuclear power. I want to. There's so many things I want to talk to you today about. I want to talk a bit more about some of the problems with nuclear reactors, and the one that's the most clear to me, and it's the one that really jumps up in your face when you look at nuclear power stations, is the problem about putting them into a state of cold shutdown, which of course was the problem with Fukushima because the generators failed, and we'll get onto that shortly. But the problem with the technology is that it's very hard to actually turn this reaction off, isn't it? I mean, you actually have to put energy into the system just to keep it cool to stop a runaway reaction causing a meltdown. But there are those who say that the newer reactors, particularly the ones that are used in France, are free of this particular problem. Can you comment on that at all?
Well, nuclear power to boil water is a little like using a chainsaw to cut butter.
Yeah.
Water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit. And in the nuclear reaction, at a typical nuclear power plant, a light water reactor, by the way, all of France's reactors are light water reactors.
Okay.
As they are here in the United States, the fissioning process, only 33% of the heat generated in that process goes to making steam and spinning a turbine generator. So you have 67% of the heat generated in the nuclear reaction that then is thermal pollution. It is at such high temperatures that if you do not remove this heat, it will damage the fuel. When you damage nuclear fuel, you also generate explosive hydrogen gas, and you have this very volatile mixture of an explosive environment with catastrophic release of radiation if it's runaway. And so this is the situation. It's a very inefficient way of generating electricity in terms of not only the heat also has to be disposed of. So that 67% is typically dumped into the atmosphere through the process of evaporation. So there's a tremendous amount of water that is used in this evaporation process, but the majority of the reactors actually just directly dump that heat into a river, a lake, the ocean, man-made reservoirs. You know, France had as here in the United States, the past few summers have been so warm that the French nuclear industry, for example, had to shut down reactors, had to power down reactors because they were losing the efficiency of the cooling because the river waters had become too warm.
We're just going to break.
Or at too low levels.
We're just going to break you with Truth News Radio Australia, talking to Paul Gunter from beyondnuclear.org. We'll be right back. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. And I'm talking to my guest, Paul Gunter, today about nuclear power, the risks on a lot of different dimensions, along a lot of different sort of ways of looking at it. And we've been looking at nuclear weapons technologies and how they tend to be associated with nuclear power, and we're looking at the risks of running the nuclear reactors. Just to finish that topic, Paul, can we shut down a nuclear reactor? I mean, are there some nuclear reactors that can be effectively turned off, or do they always have to be, like, even if you turn them off, you've still got to be running them to keep them cool?
The technology, you know, there are projections for reactors that can passively cool themselves, but you know, these are they're not in commercial development.
Really? Okay.
The idea is that you know, these reactors have to coast down, and that can take time, and it in all cases takes power. If you lose power, then you lose the ability to remove that excess heat, and that results in the uranium fuel pellets. They first begin to swell as they overheat. They then split their cladding, which then is the first breach of containment. You know, these reactors have multiple containment barriers. That initial containment barrier is the fuel rod wall cladding, and when that splits, then the radioactivity begins to get out into whatever cooling you're using, and then as the cladding begins to overheat, typically here in the United States and in the light water technology, we use a material called zirconium, as was the case in Japan at the Fukushima Daiichi reactors. Zirconium is a very strong alloy, and you can make it very thin and it very strong. It's a very efficient metal for the transfer of heat. But if you powder zirconium, that's what goes into high explosives. Zirconium powder is used in flash bulbs, but it's also used in conventional high explosives. So if you reach the combustion point for zirconium cladding in nuclear reactors, it starts with what's called an exothermic reaction. And this reaction will actually separate out the elemental form of water, hydrogen and oxygen. And that's what we saw at Fukushima, was the development of this very explosive environment that all it needed to do was find a spark. And then we saw the consequences of a hydrogen gas explosion and the rupture of containment and the catastrophic release of radioactivity, principally a Chernobyl to the ocean. In the case of Fukushima Daiichi,
absolutely. Let's talk about Fukushima then. I'd like to start with understanding what exactly happened at Fukushima, because this has not been really well explained in the mainstream media, and I suspect that a lot of information has been withheld from us. I mean, let's begin with the earthquake and the tsunami, because as I understand it, Fukushima was designed to withstand a tsunami, and it was certainly meant to be earthquake-proof, being in a zone where earthquakes are very common. So in your understanding, what actually was the damage, and how did that occur at Fukushima?
Well, Fukushima Daiichi is located on the eastern shore of Japan. And the six reactors there are General Electric boiling water reactors. This is essentially 1960s technology.
Wow.
So the United States has 31 of these reactors, essentially identical, 23 of the Mark I boiling water reactors. like Fukushima Daiichi 1 through 5, and then Fukushima Daiichi Unit 6 was a GE boiling water reactor Mark II. We have 8 of those here in the United States. I think that what people don't really realize and what the media has failed to reveal is that when Tokyo Electric Power Company originally started the construction of Fukushima back in the 1960s, they basically, as in most cases with this industry, sought to do some construction shortcuts. And the critical one here was that the TEPCO lowered the elevation of the reactor construction site by 80 feet. And so they took down a natural tsunami barrier that was there so that they could facilitate the access to the construction site for construction equipment and also ultimately to operate the reactor by lowering the grade for pumping cooling water into the into those units. And this particularly was for units 1 through 4. 5 and 6 were on a higher grade. And they justified lowering the grade for the construction site and the reactor facility based on what they call a probabilistic risk assessment that a future tsunami, there was a very low risk of anything over 10 feet, you know, roughly just over 3 meters. And in fact, what happened was a nine magnitude earthquake on March 11, 2011 occurred off the coast of Japan and generated essentially a 14 to 15 meter tsunami that overwhelmed the facility. So the earthquake knocked out the electrical grid itself, of right. which the transmission system in these nuclear reactors primarily provides the 100% of the power for all the safety systems. When you lose that offsite transmission, the plant goes into, well, it automatically scrams, which happened at the in the case of Fukushima Daiichi, and then backup power is provided from emergency diesel generators. But unfortunately, in this case, the tsunami then overwhelmed the diesel generators, which had been essentially constructed in the basement of the reactor. So they lost both the offsite and then they lost the onsite emergency alternating current. And then they went to the final backup system, which is direct current battery banks, which began to fail within just several hours.
Wow.
So they went into what a condition is called station blackout. The loss of offsite power, the loss of onsite alternating current power, and the loss of emergency direct current power. So they began essentially to lose the cooling capability at the same time the control room lost the ability to monitor the reactor conditions for 4 units. They were able to manage to keep cooling going in units 5 through 6, but within just a matter of hours, that exothermic reaction began to occur in Fukushima Daiichi 1 through 3. Unit 4 had been previously shut down for refueling, so they had moved all of the reactor fuel out of the reactor pressure vessel and put it in to storage in a essentially an elevated storage pond that sits about 60 feet up in the reactor building. But with the loss of power and control, we began to see a series of explosions, initially from the hydrogen gas, from units 1 through 3, but through a common venting system with unit 4, there was also an explosion at unit 4.
We're just going to break, sorry to interrupt. We're going to break with Truth News Radio Australia, talking to Paul Gunter. We will be right back. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. I'm talking to my guest Paul Gunter, and he is from beyondnuclear.org, and we are talking about the Fukushima Daiichi disaster. Now, Paul, you were just going through a very gripping account there of what actually happened in those critical minutes and hours after the tsunami struck, after the earthquake took out the electrical grid and the tsunami took out the diesel generators, and then the batteries failed, and I'll let you continue, but I just wanted to highlight it's quite shocking how quickly this occurred. Like, it wasn't a matter of days, it was a matter of hours before the exothermic reaction was running out of control.
Correct. And this is, again, due to the fact that the reactors are extremely thermally hot during that reaction. And so, you know, these explosions essentially ripped through the I have to also just point out that these GE Mark I reactors, we've known since 1972, being General Electric, being a U.S. corporation, that, you know, these reactors' containment systems would fail. You know, we hear commonly that with reference to Chernobyl, well, that reactor never had a containment.
Yeah.
That the Russian technology was inferior to Western technology. Well, we've got the examples now of Fukushima Daiichi as containment failures, no containment essentially under severe accident condition. Recognize that all three reactors that were operating failed to contain the accident. So that's 100% failure rate. And that's the situation. But it wasn't that we weren't forewarned. These units, this design in particular, has a very small containment that was identified decades ago as highly prone to failure in the event of an accident, but that's been ignored, and it's continued to be ignored today in the United States, where we have 31 of these units still operating, despite the evidence of Fukushima Daiichi. But you know, now the situation is that those reactor cores for units 1 through 3 melted through the reactor pressure vessel, very likely have burned into the foundation below in the concrete floor. Nobody really knows the status of those melted reactor cores because the radioactive environment essentially prohibits any kind of monitoring or even robotics
really?
That have been sent in there do not return. So don't really know the status other than tremendous amounts of radioactivity are now getting into groundwater that's flowing off the mountains behind Fukushima Daiichi into the reactor wreckage and then flowing off into the Pacific Ocean. So we have now, you know, essentially a radioactive sorcerer's apprentice where tremendous amounts of radioactive water are being generated every day, primarily from the operations to inject cooling water onto these melted reactor cores to keep them from, you know, turning into another full-blown radioactive catastrophe, and the groundwater flowing in from the facility, and all of this, they've been trying to divert this water into this huge tank farm, which is now about 1,500 tanks, but millions of gallons of radioactive water.
Yeah, I'm really curious.
Accumulating on site.
Really curious to know about that. This containment of water. I mean, how long can this go on for? I mean, how long can they continue storing water on site?
It's going to be a limited duration.
Yeah.
The tanks are being hastily built. Initially, they were bolted together rather than welded together. So we've seen numerous instances where these huge tanks have breached containment. They have been attempting to remove radioactivity through a treatment system, again, hastily built, for removing the radioactive cesium and strontium from this effort to divert the radioactive water coming out of the unit into these tanks. But yeah, that's failed.
Yeah.
So we have these huge tanks now that are leaking. Another earthquake is a big concern right now.
Absolutely.
Given that the structural failure of these multiple tank farms would send literally a reverse tsunami of radioactive water back into the ocean. The Tokyo Electric Power Company is attempting to surround the perimeter of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant with an ice wall. This is, an effort where they're looking to drill holes down to bedrock, basically 90 feet deep, put tubing down that is then spaced 3 feet apart for a mile-long perimeter, and then fill it full of refrigerant. Wow. Which would get down to minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit and literally freeze a wall of the water approaching the Fukushima Daiichi and then diverted around the perimeters. But, this is a technology that's had limited application for freezing under large bodies of water for tunneling.
Yeah.
And never really applied for an application that essentially has to be relied upon for decades to come. Again, another earthquake could disrupt either the structural integrity of the ice wall or the power supply that must provide this continuous flow of refrigerant. So this is a very, very sketchy operation, and the consequences are going to be unforgiving.
Yeah.
If we have another earthquake or just the ability to no longer economically afford the protection.
Can I just ask you briefly, because we're almost out of time, how does this disaster compare with Chernobyl? Because when the disaster was unfolding, we were continually told by the media again and again that this was nowhere near as bad as Chernobyl. And it was really played down, and it's continued to be played down, but the information is kind of seeping out in the same way that the radioactivity is seeping out. And it's becoming clear now that this really was an incredible disaster. I mean, how does it compare with Chernobyl in your view?
Well, Chernobyl was, in Ukraine and surrounded by, in the middle of a very large landmass.
Yeah.
So the explosion at Chernobyl sent this radioactive cloud that basically contaminated a very large landmass. There were food restrictions that are still in place all across Europe, Scandinavia, and even up into the United Kingdom. Fukushima was a Chernobyl to the Pacific Ocean.
Okay.
There aren't, the majority of the radioactive contamination that escaped in those multiple explosions fell into the Pacific Ocean as fallout, which and then subsequent we have this large discharge of radioactive water that continues to flow into the Pacific Ocean and into the currents of the Pacific Ocean. So it's been much more difficult to measure the extent of the radioactive contamination because of the lack of monitoring equipment. But
what about the ongoing problem with containing it? I mean, Chernobyl was contained with that giant concrete sarcophagus. I mean, did that ultimately work? Is Chernobyl more or less safe now, you know, from within its containment? And how does that compare to the prospects for making Fukushima safe?
Well, what we're seeing right now is a new concept in the idea of Russian dolls,
right,
where you have a container within a container within a container within a container. This is the story that it's going to be for ages to come. The initial sarcophagus that, you know, 600,000 Soviet troops were used in the construction of that facility. None of them were put through a cancer registry.
Wow.
So they are invisible victims of the Chernobyl catastrophe. But that sarcophagus is collapsing.
Okay.
And so now they're looking to put an overstructure over that facility. And because of the global consequences of the Chernobyl accident, you know, you have a combination of governments that are looking to that are helping Russia and Ukraine to build that facility. That's that second sarcophagus. This is going to be the story where the liability of these accidents is not going to go away. Containment once failed will be containment that has to be restored again and again and again as a biological shield. But that's the concern here is the radioactive cat is out of the bag.
Yeah.
And once that initial containment is lost, there's really no way of thoroughly cleaning up the risk and the threat to future generations.
Yeah, it's just a huge problem in our future, which we really can't envisage because we don't know what's going to happen 10, 50 years, 100 years down the track. We just don't know. We are at the end of the hour. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been a really interesting chat.
Thank you.
Terrific. And I do hope we can get you on again because there were a lot more questions I wanted to ask you. But thank you so much, Paul Gunter. And that is our show for this week. We'll be back next week. Truth News Radio Australia signing out. See you then. Great.